So I'm Laura Bellows, and I will not repeat my very long title. I'm an assistant professor and extension specialist at Colorado State University, and my research area is in the development of eating habits and physical activity patterns in early childhood. So I'm going to share, I was not funded with the $5 million, unfortunately, so ours is a smaller scale, but really what we're looking at is how do we enhance eating and activity over a three-year time frame and see if we can intervene in early childhood, can we maintain those changes into early elementary school. I have no relationships to disclose. So the question I sometimes get still is why preschoolers? And not to repeat what the data says, but we know that 26% of our preschoolers, one out of every four, is considered either overweight or obese, and these statistics are higher in those with health disparities. So our low-income minority and rural families tend to be disproportionately affected. In Colorado, only less than 10% of our preschoolers are eating the recommended servings of fruits and vegetables, so certainly they're not even close to reaching nutritional standards, nor are they getting enough physical activity. And we know that we do form our eating habits in the first 6 years of life, as well as we develop gross motor development skills, which is a precursor to physical activity habits, so it's a very critical window, early childhood, in which we can intervene from an obesity prevention perspective. So two programs that we have, back in 2000, we had a program, it's called the Food Friends, Fun with New Foods. Both programs here are past USDA funded, but with a very narrow focus, our nutrition program is social marketing campaign embedded with social cognitive theory, and really trying to get at picky eating. It was developed with the Colorado Nutrition Network, which is a statewide initiative, with a very simple goal of increasing children's willingness to try new foods. It's a 12-week intervention, 12 weeks because it takes 8 to 12 exposures to get a child to try a new food, so very purposely targeted and primarily started in Head Start. It's since expanded. In 2005, my colleagues and I added a gross physical activity component building off the popularity of the character. So our Food Friends characters have been revamped since 2000, but they have superpowers and gross motor skills and so forth. They all live in the town of Healthadelphia, where they do all kinds of fun things and role play with the kids. But our activity component is very focused on motor development as a precursor to activity. Both programs we've published have had the results that we intended. So with the nutrition program, we have increased the number of refusals of new foods that kids have tried, and we have increased the affective rating that kids think about new foods. And then with the Mighty Moves program, we did have a significant increase in the rate of gross motor development compared to our control sites. So the question that we've got, I'm skipping a slide because they put them in backwards, is so that's great. You get kids to try these wacky foods, you get them over picky eating, and they can stand on one foot. What does that have to do with weight status in little kids is what my basic science colleagues ask. And so what we're really looking at doing is we're looking at our predictive behavior. So the fun with new foods, we increase willingness to try new foods, we think we increase self-confidence among kids, and does that have an impact on dietary intake? Not necessarily in the preschool years, but longitudinally down the road, is that something that we can see? And then what's the impact on weight status and healthy growth? Likewise, on the activity side, does motor development have an impact on physical activity? It's been hypothesized that children who have improved self-confidence in the way they move tend to have better skills, which will then translate potentially to higher physical activity levels. So that's the framework in which we were operating, and then got funded through USDA to do a longitudinal study where we're following kids from their last year in preschool through first grade to see if the behavior changes that these programs have done is sustained. We're also looking at the mediating or the predictive behaviors and how do they impact dietary intake and quality as well as activity down that line as well. So Colorado is a big rectangle. To show you where we are, Colorado State University is up north in Fort Collins. Our colleagues that we partner with are at the Medical Center in Aurora, which is just east of Denver. We are in five very rural communities and very different communities. Out east are our ranching communities. And the geography reminds us a lot of Kansas, where Colorado is not all mountains. The green is the mountains. We are in Leadville, Colorado, which is the highest community in North America at 10,200 feet. The population there, they service the ski industry. So we have a lot of Hispanics that are service industry workers, as well as the mine. We have a mineral mine. And then Salida and Buena Vista are lower in our central Colorado mountains. So as great as the communities are, they are far from campus. So it makes it, it would have been nice to have the 5 million. So this is our study design. It's a three-year, three-cohort design where we're collecting data on the kids and intervening in preschool, kindergarten, first grade. In preschool, they get our traditional Food Friends Mighty Moves, 12 weeks of nutrition, 18 weeks of motor. We decided as a group that we did not think it would be realistic to not have any type of intervention in kindergarten and first grade and expect to see maintain in the behaviors. So from a marketing perspective, we reinforce our messages of Super Taster and Mighty Mover in the classroom in kindergarten and then classroom and home in first grade. It's not meant to be its own intervention versus just really encouraging and reminding students of those behaviors that we're encouraging. We collect data at baseline in the fall and post-intervention in preschool. Those are our time one, time two points, and then we go back once a year in kindergarten and first grade. This is what our what we call our booster looks like. Just to give you an idea, it's our kindergarten booster. We have banners and posters. We're in the classrooms talking to the kids with the characters about, are you a super taster? So Tina Tortilla says, I am because I get wrapped up in new foods. And our extension educator is actually making veggie wraps with the kids where they get to put in different new vegetables into their veggie wraps with that. Rudy Radish, is he a mighty mover? I am because I have a ball kicking and throwing. So we kind of play on words with the characters. In first grade, we send home. This was all recess time, formative work, where kids are really interested at this age in getting mail. So Healthadelphia, the mail comes from Healthadelphia, where they get a personalized newsletter. Parents also get a newsletter, some kind of educational enhancer. There's a code word that's interwoven within that they can text or email back to us, which is a nice way to get some evaluation data on reach. And really, we're just reinforcing and promoting those two concepts that the kids have seen throughout. So from an assessment perspective, when you get a review back and they say the evaluation plan is impressive, it means you're crazy. This is, we're looking at everything from a social ecological model. So I'm going to walk you just through our model a little bit. Down in the corner with the Food Friends and New Foods, that's our intervention that we know has an impact on increasing children's willingness to try new foods. In the red box is our child characteristics. So we do a tasting panel individually with each child where we give them 9 foods that are either novel or familiar and ask them to rank it on an affective scale. Smiley face for yummy, neutral for just okay and yucky. Parents report on neophobia, oral sensory characteristics. So parents also get a big evaluation packet. And then we do a self-concept and look at their perceived competence across many scales with that. From a diet perspective, we're doing plate waste at the end of lunch as well as food frequency questionnaire that parents fill out, height weight for BMI indicating our growth. On the motor, on the activity side, we do gross motor skills with each child about a half an hour, as well as self-concept around athletic competence. And then we're putting pedometers on both kids and parents, and then we have a large subsample that we have accelerometers on for 6 days. We have a home environment inventory scale that's looking at availability and accessibility of foods, sedentary devices, as well as physical activity to understand the home environment, as well as looking at parenting practices, both from a feeding as well as an activity perspective. And then we're using Knapsack in preschool and another school environment survey to get an idea of what's going on in the school environment. Lots and lots of data that's coming in across all levels of the social ecological model. So to not worry too much about the numbers, but this is our progress to date. We did in the spring collect time for data on cohort one. It might be one of the few studies. We actually increased our N from time 3 to 4 because we found some kids who are in some more remote rural communities that we got to test. Our parent participation dropped off, and basically the only thing we didn't do was go knock on doors really, really loud in the middle of the night to try to get them to return their packets. But we are trying to increase that for our cohort two. So we total of our study subjects is we started at baseline with 233 at baseline with all three cohorts. So we're talking about an N of 200 when we look at some of our analyses. To give you an idea of who our participants are, they start at about their 4.5 years of age, a little higher in female. 44% Hispanic. I would say the other 55% is white. We're pretty much a Hispanic or white state. Weight category, about one-third of our kids fall in the overweight or obese category. 90% of mothers completed the packet. We have some discrepancies with some of our demographics with our communities. On average, the education, 33% are high school or less, and income, 70% or so are less than poverty. We recruited at Head Starts, but in the rural communities, a Head Start isn't just a Head Start. They're a child care center that takes a large portion of Head Start, but then also has tuition-based and other funding to really be a child care center. So we did not discriminate based on what type of funding was funding that child. So we do have some higher income folks in our study population. So quick results. We're still really cleaning and getting our data, but our baseline data, what we're finding is parents are very reliable in reporting their neophobia. So in comparing how a parent perceives their child is highly correlated with our on-site tasting panels. What we do know is that the more neophobic a child is, the more likely a parent is will pressure the child to eat, has concern that their child is not eating, and employs restrictive feeding practices. The restrictive is not necessarily not offering foods as in dieting versus they're restrictive in the types of foods they offer, meaning they're feeding their kids the foods they know they'll eat and not necessarily a wide variety. We also found a relationship with parent feeding practices and child neophobia that's mediated by oral sensory characteristics. So kids who have oral sensory characteristics tend to be more neophobic, and parents tend to put more pressure on eating and are more concerned that their kids aren't getting enough food with that. So it's a new finding in our low-income minority populations and something we're going to explore throughout. From an activity perspective, we use the Brunix-Ostrowski BOT2 motor test, which is norm referenced, and we look at 4 subscales. Two of which, balance, running speed, I got 2 minutes, okay. Running speed and agility were significantly different, meaning that our intervention group, the rate of progress increased more so than the control. But I do want to note that in these Head Start at-risk kids, they're still not up to the average or norm. So we may have improved their development, but we haven't got them to the point we would really like to see them at. And the results, unlike the literature, our results did not differ based on gender or BMIZ at baseline. A snippet on our home environment. So the availability of the foods based on our inventory scale, we compared that with our food frequency and child's food consumption and looked at some key nutrients. And after controlling for our demographic variables, income, education, and parent education, we did find that the home availability significantly predicted fruit, vegetable, and whole grain calories from those foods, but it failed to predict sugar-sweetened beverages. So the potential impact of our study that we hope is that we'll provide some more evidence longitudinally among children's weight status as well as their food preference and consumption. We'll be able to potentially look at things that potentially motor development at baseline may be predictive of physical activity levels as first graders, and what's the influence on the home environment related to both feeding practices, food intake, as well as activity practices and activity levels. So that's where we're trying to look at this ecologically. We'll see how that pans out with the number of assessments that we do get, and hopefully that this will have some recommendations for obesity prevention strategies for early childhood. So lastly, I do want to acknowledge it is a big team from both Colorado State as well as the University of Colorado, with lots of students and interns as well, and we are very fortunate to have some USDA funding. So do we want to take one question? So we're going to take maybe one or two questions at the end of each, and then we'll have more at the end. Yeah, Nancy. We haven't looked at that analytically. Anecdotally, what I might say actually is those that are lower income, we do provide a stipend, and those are the folks who are like, when's it coming? So there might be some confounding there by the need for the money. But good question. Yes. What do we pay? So at year one, they get $20 at pre and $20 at post, and then year two and three, it's $40, so $40 a year. The beauty of working in rural communities is they are so appreciative that someone's paying attention to them. So a lot of folks have said, we're just so excited the universities are paying attention to us. So we've had really good relationships with them as well. So thank you.